Cool. So hi, this is Josh from Collection DX, and we're here at HobbyLink Japan in Sano in Tochigi Prefecture?
Yep, Tochigi Prefecture.
Which is about, I don't know, 90 minutes north of Tokyo. And I'm here with Scott Hards, president of HobbyLink Japan, owner, head honcho.
The man.
So, I think a lot of people are surprised to hear that, you know, there's an American in charge of HobbyLink Japan. How did that come about? How did you go from being, you know, I think you were working as a translator, was it?
Or? Yeah, that's what I had been doing at the time I started HobbyLink. But a couple of years before that, I had been a banker. Well, the short story is I joined a Japanese bank out of school, worked for them for about 6 years, started to decide that really wasn't what I wanted to do with my life, and while I was floundering around, I went into a financial reporting company, well, it's the Thompson Corporation, a big company out of Canada that owns some newspapers and specialty publications. I worked as a Tokyo-based financial reporter for them for about 18 months or so. During that time, I also hardened my belief that, you know, this really wasn't what I was interested
right.
in doing.
Were you a hobby? Were you a fan of like the hobby goods?
Personally? Yeah, a little bit. My real passion at the time, and still to extent today, is aircraft.
Okay.
You know, that's why I gave you that long drawn out explanation about the MV-11 and DC-10. I'm a big aircraft fan.
Sure.
And I had gotten, rediscovered my deep interest in aircraft. I think it was during the first Gulf War,
okay.
When, you know, every night, you know, you got CNN running some, besides scenes of destruction, they were doing these specials like once a night on each of the aircraft that's participating in the conflict, and they were doing sort of a technical analysis of what it does and what it's supposed to do and all of that. And I just remember one night, you know, because I'm deeply interested in aircraft, and I was working at the bank on a schedule that brought me pretty much to the dinner table at the same time every day, and so they were running these segments the same time every day, and I was seeing every one of them, and I don't know, it was on the third or fourth night, I just snapped. They were doing a report on the A-10.
The Warthog. Right?
Yeah, Warthog, I got one up there. They were doing a report on the A-10, I was just like, that is a cool airplane, I gotta build that,
yeah.
You know. And at the time, I had built some robot models when I was doing my exchange program here in Japan. I'd, you know, done all of the cheap chintzy ones everybody does as a kid and hangs from their room, you know, with fishing line
sure.
Kind of thing. But I'd never as an adult before really thought about seriously building a model. And so I bought myself an A-10 kit and I built my A-10, which is the one that's up there, but it's not very good. At the time, my skills weren't very honed. But I just began doing models as an adult at that point. And, you know, I haven't been able to do a lot of mass production of models, but I've done, I don't know, 20 or 30 in the years that I've been doing it. But I was into aircraft. So one day while I was working for the Thompson Corporation, I was looking at a book on the Japanese Zero during my lunch break at a local bookstore. And I noticed that the book had captions that were in English and Japanese. And I thought, well, that's kind of cool. It's got a Japanese publisher who's looking real internationally minded and everything. But when I started to read the English captions, they were just tortured. I mean, they were just terrible. That's terrible English. I mean, I could tell what they were trying to say.
Sure.
It was just a mess. And I thought to myself, since I wasn't enjoying my job at the time anyway, I thought, you know, doing side work like this would be just right up my alley. I mean, I know Japanese, I know English, I know aircraft.
Yeah, so you help them with the translations and such.
So I looked up the publisher's name and gave him a call, and I said, like, introduce myself and told him what I was interested in. And he's like, can you, like, come down, like, right now? I was like, oh, well, actually, no, I'm kind of, you know, at lunch at a different company, but I could take a day and come see you guys. So a couple days later, I think I went down to this publisher and literally walked out with work under my arm,
wow.
You know, of the next book in their series. And this company is a company called Artbox, which still exists, and they publish Model Graphics magazine, among other stuff.
Yep.
They had Model Graphics, also Armor Modeling and Scale Aviation, which are their two specialty titles, which didn't exist at the time. At the time, it was just Model Graphics. Plus, they were doing these aero detail books on the aircraft. Now, I was kind of, you know, contracted to do some work for them on the translation for the air books, but when I was coming at the time to do the work, because there was no real big internet yet, so you had to actually like do the work basically on site, you know, use their computers.
What's the time frame you think this was?
This was 94, 3 or 4,
okay.
Probably 1993, I think. And I started to do that work for them, and I became really, really intensely exposed to plastic models because all of the manufacturers send them samples out the wazoo. And you go into their office, and the poor place is just packed literally to the ceiling in some places with these sample kits they've been given. or things that, you know, contributors have built for them, yeah, for the magazine, for the pages of the magazine. Sometimes, surprisingly, some of those guys, they don't even want these creations back. They're just happy to get them in the magazine or whatever. And so the place is just crammed with models. So while I'm, you know, waiting for the printers to print, this was back in the day when it took a while for laser, sure, printers to, you know, print a page.
Yeah.
You know, I just kind of wander around the office looking at stuff, and I start looking at kits, and I'm looking at the Tamiya kits and the Hasegawa kits. And then I go and I look at maybe an Ilari kit or a Monogram kit out of the United States, and I'm starting to notice it's like, wow, these are kind of different. It's kind of like the Japanese kits are really sharp and crispy looking, and some of the overseas kits are kind of soft and mushy looking. And I remember back in the day when, you know, I built kids as a kid that, you know, so the left half of the fuselage and the right half of the fuselage doesn't really meet up exactly right. Well, that's what files are for, right?
Putty and files.
Putty and files. And it was like, you know, it just never occurred to me, as silly as this may sound, that there were significant differences in quality.
Yeah.
So I'm looking at the Japanese kits and thinking, wow, I guess these are kind of better. And then about, you know, 1994 happens and the internet starts to explode in the United States, and my parents get on my back to get on it because, you know, they're boys over in Japan, and compared to faxes and international phone calls, you know, email is just like a godsend for instant global communications. So it was actually my parents who got on my case. So like, you got to get an internet connection now. So I found one of Japan's fledgling providers at the time, because this was still the realm of computer magazine reading nerds. This was not mainstream at all at,
sure,
this point. But I found the internet thing, and I got myself an account. I'll, of course, dial up 2400 baud modem and all of that good stuff.
Yeah.
But I got on the net, and I quickly discovered the RetDoc models.scale news group. Remember those?
Yeah. I used
well, Google Groups, still exist as a segment, yeah, of Google Groups. I don't know how much participation there is these days, because I don't look at it anymore. But I was participating in the RetDoc models.scale group. And since I was in the offices of this company, I was often looking at samples of upcoming new products even before they were in the magazines. So I would put my you know, information on the web, the web. There wasn't a web yet. It was just these text groups, you know. And it's like, hey, Hasegawa's got a new Hellcat out. I'm looking at a test shot. It looks really cool or whatever. You know, I'd put this kind of stuff up. And at the time, my email address ended in .jp. So a lot of people began to realize, oh, he's really in Japan. Cool.
Nice.
So out of the blue, I start getting email from people I don't know. Hey, Scott, I'll send you $50. Will you send me the new Hasegawa, whatever it is? You know, because I can't get it over here for another year, or I can get it over here, but it's 3 times the Japanese price, right, or whatever it is. And this didn't happen just once or twice. This started happening very regularly. Right about that time, I also found that there was the president, who's since deceased, of Artbox, came over to me one day with a fax from an American bookseller that they were doing business with. And the fax from the bookseller was basically, you know, thanks for all your business. There's this other publisher in Japan who makes these really great books that we want to buy, but no matter how many faxes we send them, they never answer us. Could you broker the trade for us? What was surprising to me is this was a pretty large, well-known publisher that, okay, they were talking about. And I was amazed that a company of their stature would not, you know, if you get a fax from overseas begging to buy product, you know, normally you'd think it'd be like, okay, yeah, you can send us your money. But they apparently found the challenge of doing business in English so daunting, they didn't want to bother to make money off.
Right.
So, you know, you think about Japanese exporting, and you think Sony and Panasonic and, you know, Toyota and places like that, and how they've taken over the world in their various segments, and are some of the most, you know, proficient exporting machines there are. But on the other hand, when you get down to the little 20 and 30 man or even less size, small and medium-sized Japanese companies, they're just like, oh, geez, Bill, do you read English? I don't read English. Wow, I don't know. You know, do this, sure, thing? You know, they just kind of throw their hands up in despair and walk away from it. You know, so it didn't take a Harvard, you know, business school, you know, genius to figure out, it's like, okay, somebody's making good stuff over here, but it ain't getting over there very well.
Yeah.
Maybe we could do something here to help this. But, you know, the whole notion of e-commerce really wasn't going yet either. And all I could think of was, you know, what? Somehow get the money to print a catalog and then airdrop it randomly around the world and hope I get orders. You know, I didn't have the money or the wherewithal to do that. So I had been mulling that notion. I mean, it had struck me that this opportunity existed if I just had the wherewithal to make it happen for maybe a year or so. And of course, the internet really started to explode pretty quickly.
Right.
And after toying around with the fledgling World Wide Web in probably 95 early or so, I began to realize, well, yeah, this is yeah, this could work. You know, this is a way to do business.
Sure.
And I think it was, you know, I registered HLJ and started doing, or the domain, HLJ.com. That's why I will put a company like ours actually has a 3-letter.com.
I know, that's pretty amazing.
Yeah, I get offers for it all the time. They never quote a price. I usually tell them I'll sell for $2 or $3 million, but I guess that sort of stratospheric prices are reserved for dictionary word.coms. A couple, three times a year, people write to me to say, you know, would you be willing to sell HLJ.com? I'm generally not willing to. But I think Amazon only started like 4 or 5 months before we did. Although at the time it wasn't we, it was me.
Yeah.
It was just me packing boxes and running around to local hobby shops and picking up stuff. I think it was the fall of 95 when I first started deciding that this would be an interesting way to supplement my income. So at the time, after Artbox started giving me the translation work, I'd also picked up some other odd translation and freelance journalistic type jobs. And I had quit the Thompson Corporation. I was just kind of totally winging it on my own. And I started, filling orders and running around and trying to help people in the fall of 95. And within a year, it was beyond what I could do.
Yeah.
Early in 96, I taught myself a little bit of HTML and put up a really primitive website, although it wasn't interactive in any way. It was just kind of a mission statement.
Sure.
You know, I'm over here, you're over there, you want some stuff, send me an email. We'll work it out. You know, that was basically what it said. There was no search engine or any of that modern stuff going yet at all. But even at that level, by the fall of 1996, I remember it was one day in August when I had spent like all day on a Sunday answering and responding to emails, some 200 emails or so that I had to get through, and I got them done, you know, late in the evening and just kind of collapsed in a pile on the floor and went to bed. Got up the next morning, turned on my modem, pulled my mail, and there was like another 230 or something. I'm just I can't do this. I can't do this by myself. So I very shortly made the decision that if I was going to continue with this, it had to be done in a professional way and not just some guy in his spare time kind of way, because it wasn't leaving me any spare time, for one thing. So I took the plunge, basically tossed all of my other work, and spent a couple of months getting together a couple other guys to help out, getting a loan from the Japanese Small Business Association, surprisingly.
How was that to... I would be a kind of a foreigner, even though you were
established. Yeah, I was a foreigner. I wasn't even incorporated, and Gishka left. So anyhow, got some guys. Yeah, the money part. I wasn't incorporated. I was a foreigner, and it was the the Japanese at the time called it Pasokon Tsushin, which just means personal computer, communications, sure. Literally. So it's like, this whole notion of, you link them together. So I was frigging amazed, to be honest, that when I went down to the small business place, explained my business plan, what I was trying to do, that they actually loaned me at the time what was about the equivalent of $50,000.
Yeah. Wow.
Me and a couple of the guys got going at that point. One of them had a few computer programming skills. He started to put together, primitive search engine for us, and I started working on the initial database of kits, which was, at first, it was entirely just scale plastic models.
Yeah.
We weren't doing toys at all. That launched in its rudimentary form in, we were down for 4 or 5 months getting ready, and then in January of 1997, the company, we incorporated it as an actual real business, and also launched, the new website. There we are. First year's sales were, I don't know, something like U.S. equivalent was probably about $800,000.
Wow.
That was for a year
that's
of sales. But we do well over that a month now.
Oh, I can imagine.
so yeah, we're I think our sales have increased like, 15 times in 13 years or something.
That's amazing.
It's cliche, but as they say, the rest is history. It just kind of grew steadily from there.
So what would you say, now obviously Vintage Japan is much more than kits. You have your your PVC figures, you have your anime goods, you have the actual the toys themselves.
Mm-hmm.
What's the ratio of, like, is it still mostly kits, or is it leaning more towards toys now?
Well, it depends on how you define it. If you were to count by just number of pieces sold, kits would be holding their own a bit better.
Sure.
But when you look at just raw numbers,
right.
Particularly the cool stuff, the cool Japanese toys, all the the die-cast transforming, what's its, you know, those babies run, you know, anywhere from 5,000 to 20,000 yen.
Yeah, so the dollar value brings those up.
Oh, yeah. And the, you know, plastic kits by their nature are just parts on a runner hurled in a box. I mean, it's the consumer's job to make it into something. So, you know, those are $20, $30, you know, maybe a tenth of the value.
Right.
So even, you know, so there's really no way dollar-wise that they could make up a comparatively large part of our sales next to the really cool completed stuff.
Is there anything that you that really surprised you in the terms of it, that really took off? I mean, because when Hublin Japan up until I think a couple of years ago was strictly for overseas markets. It was in Japan, but did anything really, like, you got a lot of demand for something that you didn't think you'd get, like, you know, cosplay merchandise or something like that? Anything that surprised you?
Well, I guess I'm always kind of personally surprised by the strength of the anime related merchandise, especially for titles that have little or no, you know, overseas distribution.
Sure.
I mean, they're not on Cartoon Network or something. They might be just DVD distribution only. Really, very, very niche market, you know, for that kind of, what is essentially, you know, they call direct-to-video kind of stuff. Yet, there's enough of demand out there to support, you know, quite a lucrative business for us with the figures, the completed anime figures, which over the last 3 to 4 years have been, you know, just really, really big movers.
Right.
I think it's starting to chill out a little bit now. Of course, the economy's helping with that a bit too.
Yeah.
And I think people are running out of shelf space. But I personally watched some anime and like that kind of stuff. And you know, I might be inspired to put maybe one figure of the lead character or something on my shelf. But I'm continuously amazed by how, you know, minor variations or color changes or whatever, you know, usually are strong sellers anyway. In that particular.
So you mentioned the economy. How has that affected Hobbylink Japan's business? And is there anything that has proven to be kind of like recession proof in terms of, you know, like, have things become like Revoltex and Figmas, where they're a low price point? Have those still stayed strong versus the higher end CMs, Brave Gokens, that to me $200-$300?
To be honest, we haven't really broken our sales down that carefully in terms of like trends by price bracket or things like that. Overall, what I can tell you is that we are probably going to see our first year ever of a significant decline in our sales. Although I wouldn't call it significant. It's still going to be single digits in terms of percentage drop. But we've, you know, basically have known no such phenomena previously in our history.
Yeah.
6 or 7 years ago, there was a bit of a downturn as well, but it didn't really hit us at all. But this time, I don't think it's so much the economy as foreign exchange. And this is speculative because we can't know why a person has chosen not to buy.
Yeah.
You know, unless somehow we had some way of interviewing all those people who decided that day not to go to our website for whatever reason.
Yeah.
We can't know why they've decided not to buy, but compared to 9 months ago, both the dollar and the euro are down 30% or more against the yen.
Yeah.
Put another way, it's as if we just decided to raise prices by 30% in a relatively short period of time. And that's got to be a hit no matter how you look at it.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't please people doing that. Not that we did it in an active way, of course, but... And I'm frankly pretty happy that the sales hit we've seen so far has been less than 10%, given that massive shift in foreign exchange.
Sure.
Because that was frankly pretty scary. It was pretty darn scary. As far as the actual merchandise itself, as you know all too well, the merchandise that we sell is utterly unnecessary.
Completely. Yes.
There, you know, this is the kind of thing that one would think, you know, when someone becomes financially desperate, it'd be one of the first to go.
Yeah.
But it's not.
No, people will forego food to
yes,
get.
Exactly.
Yeah, I know. I've been there. You know,
when you're talking about, you know, cars, hard goods of that nature, you know, you can always wait another year or two as long as it's not broke right now.
Yep.
You know. Food, you can always step down from, you know, the caviar to the cup noodles or whatever it is you need to do.
Sure.
You know, there's always a change that you can make, apparently.
Yeah.
But when it comes to this stuff, you got to have it, you got to have it. And that's all there is to it.
Well, it's one of the things that we found. our business has actually gone up during this because everybody really wants to know, is my $200 going to be well spent on this?
Right.
You know? So it shows that people still really want this stuff, but they're being very careful about what they throw their money to.
That's true. There's a lot of analysis that goes on by talking heads during these kinds of downturns, subscribe to pretty much, is that it's not that people don't want to spend money or aren't spending money. It's that they're just much more selective, which is what you were touching on. That's why Apple can have a huge quarter in the middle of the recession, because people are looking at Apple and saying, yeah, this is probably worth my money.
Yeah.
Whereas when you're flush with cash, you tend to make spur-of-the-moment decisions, with a corner of your brain saying, if I don't like it, I just throw it away or just go buy a different one or whatever. And that's the kind of thing you tend not to do when you're spending in a tight situation. But with this stuff, I think you're right. People have pretty much established that this is something they want. They know it gives them pleasure, and they're going to spend their money on it.
Right.
So, in that regard, it is a very recession-resistant industry. A lot of people tend to presume that our business is really, really U.S.-centric.
Yeah.
And the U.S. is our biggest market, but it's only 30% of the total.
Okay.
So 70% of our sales are to places outside of the United States.
So like Europe and...
Particularly Italy, France, Spain, Britain are huge for us.
Right.
Right now, especially Italy and France, they have very strong, thriving anime cultures going over there right now, too.
Yeah, there's a big...
The big disappointment is Germany, to be honest. Really? I don't know what it is with the Germans. We have more sales to Spain than we do to Germany.
That's bizarre.
Yeah, when you look at the size of the economies, it's kind of like, wow. So the Germans are disappointing me greatly. I don't know what we need to do there. But the Latin countries in Europe are very strong sales bases for us. Brazil is good, too. Mexico a little bit. So.
We have a lot of fans in like Venezuela, Argentina, things like that.
Pretty much anywhere that's got the media presence, generates the demand.
And we've also noticed a correlation when, if anime showed there in the 70s, you now have the adult collectors who are looking to track those things down and have disposable income.
Those
are big high spots as well.
Mm-hmm.
You have on display the HLJ version, the Grozier X, the color version. How did it come out for doing exclusives, and do you have more exclusives planned, your own HLJ runs of different things?
We're always looking for interesting ideas. The Grozier came out just as the economy was starting to get squidgy on us.
Sure.
So we're a little bit conservative right now on building up inventory because when you do an exclusive like that, it requires you to pretty much commit to a large product run from the get-go. Normally, we have the luxury of saying, okay, give me 100 of those. Okay, they're running out. All right, give me another 50.
Yeah.
Oh, they're running out. Give me another 20. Whatever it is.
Yeah.
Whereas when you want to do an exclusive with the manufacturer, you have to say, okay, I'll take 500 up front, and they deliver all 500
and
they
want you to
pack up the truck. So there's quite a bit more inventory investment required in something like that, regardless of how well it's going to sell. And right now, given what we've seen with the economy and our sales downturn, we're trying to be a bit more conservative on our inventory investment right now, and really only spend on what we know is going to be able to be turned around very quickly.
Right.
If on an exclusive, it was if you could really turn around the entire production run instantly, it would be a no-brainer.
Yeah.
Anybody and their brother would want to go do it. But there's a bit of an investment and a time schedule that you have to look at on that. So we don't have any concrete plans right immediately for something new. We love this stuff as much as our customers do.
Yeah.
And just the sort of the pride you get from knowing that that's our exclusive one out there or whatever, even if it is just a color change, we get as big of a head trip out of that as the consumers do playing with it. So we definitely want to do it again, but we don't have any immediate plans.
You recently started carrying vinyl from companies like M1
mm-hmm.
and things like that. People are really glad that you're doing that because vinyls are typically tough to get,
mm-hmm.
Especially because they're lower runs and things like that. Any plans to expand to other small to medium sized vinyl manufacturers?
Oh yeah, absolutely. That's one of the ways that I'm trying to really distinguish HLJ. As I pointed out, HLJ got started shortly after Amazon, so I don't want to make it sound like I copied their idea or anything of that nature, but. Personally, I use Amazon all the time, and one of the reasons I do that is because, number one, they're comprehensive. If it's out there and I want it, like if it's a DVD or a game or a CD or a book, I know they're going to have it.
Yeah.
I could go waste time, surfing all over the place trying to find it and then comparing prices and all that, or I could just go to Amazon and just buy it. You know, and it might be a couple bucks more. Maybe it is. You know, I'm sure there are people out there who look at Amazon's prices and mark everything $2 lower just because. But it's just not worth my time, you know, to go do it that way. And I'm thinking that yeah, they're going to have it sort of approach that I have to Amazon as something that could benefit us very much as well. So fortunately, we're not a brick and mortar, so we don't have to do a lot of measurement of, you know, returns per square meter in the whatever department the way a Walmart type of place may want to do. We pretty much, in terms of our cost per square foot, it's so cheap out here, you know, that we can afford to put in anything. And so when I look at a new product line, I'm not drawing arbitrary lines in the sand like a lot of American retailers do. Say, look, are we going to be able to turn over at least $100,000 worth of this stuff a year? Yeah, I just forget it. It's just too puny for us to bother with. I don't have that attitude at all. In fact, I could give you an extreme example. You know, I'm working with an independent, I don't even want to call it a publisher because it's just a guy. You know, it's a guy.
Sure.
You know, who published a book about aviation, American military aviation clothing through World War II.
Okay.
Yeah.
Kind of a niche subject.
Oh, yeah, kind of. And he self-published the book, and we're carrying it. You know, where do I get it? I got to just send him an email saying I need a couple more. The book is so niche, you know, and self-published and so carefully researched and given all the time and effort and into it. He's charging $200 a copy for this thing.
Wow.
Even though it's only it's not even like this huge book. It's this little A4 size.
It's basically on-demand printing. Yeah,
exactly. You know, and that's about as niche as it gets. You know, but we're still carrying that kind of stuff. You know, because our systems let us, and we've got plenty of floor space. And I just think that kind of comprehensiveness really is appealing to the consumer. I mean, I know it's appealing to me. And, you know, when I make a lot of decisions about HobbyLink, be it what to stock or how to handle our business or customer service issues, I just look at myself and say, okay, if I was shopping at Amazon and the same thing happened, you know, what would I want Amazon to say to me?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Or what would I expect them to say to me? And I consider myself to be a pretty reasonable person. And I just say that to our customers. And, you know, you can be as fair as you want. You're still going to have, you know, 1 out of 10 people still going to go ballistic because they, you know, they want you to, you know, they think that the customer is the Lord God Almighty and that they, you know, just because they chose to purchase from you that they, you know, can now demand that you bow down and kiss their feet or whatever.
Sure.
And a lot of people, I guess, although customer service, you know, and the customer is king, you know, works good to an extent. It only works good to the extent that helps you maximize your profitability through good customer relations. But, you know, maintaining a relationship with a customer that ends up costing you money, you know, a particular transaction might cost you money.
Yeah.
You know, so we might lose money on a transaction, but by putting that right, we get future business from this customer. Obviously, that makes sense. But there are customers out there, I'm obviously digressing from your question.
That's quite right.
Anybody who's worked retail will have similar war stories. There are customers that you have to be able to see, hopefully, early in the process, are the sort of people who are always going to be a problem.
Yeah.
They are always going to need a replacement. They're always going to find paint flecks in the wrong spot on their mass-produced, you know, toy, or whatever it is, and, you know, we have to cut those people loose as quickly as we can.
Yeah, and you've noticed, you know, some of the disclaimers, you know, this is a mass-produced toy, some detail and paint may be necessary.
Van Gogh did not hand-paint this.
Correct. For you. All right. Well, that's pretty good for us. So basically, we have a ton of people that read our site that order from HLJ and really love your service. And I've been using it for years.
I'm down here to those people in this video.
Anything you want to say to Collection DX audience or in general, anything like that?
I love you, and I don't mean that facetiously. I mean, when you walked in today, Josh, you were very impressed by our facilities, and it's entirely thanks to our customers. You know, the fact that we have thousands of customers, and particularly the kind of customers, you know, who go through a site like yours, the sort of people who are very deeply interested in the hobby and continue to bless us with their business over and over again as repeat, you know, core users, are the kind of folks who have, you know, allowed us to have this kind of facility, which ironically then is allowing us to serve them even better. I don't know if they've noticed, but our turnaround time is way better than it was a couple of years ago. And that's thanks to the facility, but it just kind of feeds on itself, you know.
Yeah.
I want them to know, if anything, and we go to IPMS and some of the shows once in a while because it gives us a chance to meet people face to face, which unfortunately is something that doesn't happen too often in the mail order business. But we want them to know that a good chunk of our staff is geeks just as geeky as they are, who love this stuff as much as they do, and are often making irrational purchasing decisions for us the same way they do.
That's awesome.
And, you know, it's kind of like geeky stuff by geeks for geeks, I guess, would be a way to put it. You know, I'm not as off the deep end on the anime stuff as some of our customers, of course, are. I'm more the military stuff. But at the same time, when I was in school, I built a lot of models of Elgin and mm-hmm. some Gundam stuff. You know, to this day, I'm a Star Trek nut and have a couple of the Enterprises at home.
Sure.
You know, so I'm up there with the best of them, or close anyway.
You excited for the new movie?
Oh, yeah. Although, I don't know. You know, a lot of people hated Star Trek the Motion Picture, I guess because there wasn't enough exploding in it.
I love the early Star Trek movies.
And while some of the V'ger flyovers were a little dull, I thought that the really highbrow, high-level science fiction, hardcore science fiction storyline, I really liked it.
Yeah.
You know, and at least from the trailers of what J.J. Abrams done, it's like, okay, everything explodes. Plus we get TNA. Okay,
yep.
So it's kind of like lowest common denominator modern stuff. But I would like to...
Hopefully there's another layer in there that doesn't come across in the trailers, you know?
Yeah.
You do need to get the seats in the theater.
Yeah, I would like there to be at least some kind of, you know, of a really good hardcore science fiction thread in there, because that's what always has made Star Trek great.
Sure.
And if there is one, you can't pick it up from the trailer.
Hmm.
The last movie I saw in the theater that was a really good... You know, take a few minutes to get your head around this concept, I think, was the original Matrix film, which to me, the whole notion of the parallel universes and how they interacted was quite fresh and took some thinking for a moment.
Yeah, one of our writers, Adam, is an enormous Matrix fan throughout the whole trilogy. He's studied the underlying meanings and everything.
Right.
He's way hardcore into it, so... Yeah, there's an appreciation for that.
So yeah, I'm hoping it's got some really good Star Trek-y stuff in it, and not just cool explosions, which I like as much as the next guy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're gonna force me to watch Uhura undress. Oh, damn! You know, shield my eyes. But you know, I'm hoping that's just the eye candy for the trailer, and that there's some really good stuff in there too.
Cool. Well, thank you for taking the time to talk with us, and I think after this, we're probably gonna go do some. Pouring around.
Oh, yeah, rip yourself up.
Awesome.
Yeah,
it'd be great. So, thanks a lot for listening, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks a lot.